the requirement for monks and nuns, but monks primarily at that time, was that they had to be supported, and even today they have to be supported daily for their food. So while monks could go wherever they were invited, if they were sincere people interested in the Dharma, they could only stay there if they were supported by the offering of food each day, and a place to stay, and medicine if they got ill, and housing, which are the four requisites for a monk. But even with all that, when the Buddha was asked who would lead the Sangha after his passing, he said he declined to name anyone, but instead he said, let the Dharma be your teacher. You've heard the Dharma, you've practiced the Dharma, let your experience be your teacher. I think that's significant for all of us, because we have had teachers, we've had leaders, leaders of sanghas, we've had teachers, many different teachers, and you know, while all of us have room for improvement, let's say, maybe not have not yet finished the whole task, we have some understanding. And in a large group like the SIMS, the Seattle Sangha, there's a lot of people that have practiced a long time. And there's a lot of understanding here. And so when we think of this Sangha, and we think of the fabric of this community, we could say that the Dharma is the warp and our practice is the weft. Because without the Dharma, we wouldn't be practicing in a way that we could create a Sangha like this, or a community, a self-sustaining and self-supporting and self-helping community. And so it's through the Dharma and our practice of the Dharma, hearing the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, realizing the Dharma to the extent that we have, and sharing it with one another, that we're able to sustain ourselves on this path. So when we're talking about the fabric of our community, we're talking about how we all practice the Dharma in order to fabricate this community. Because the etymology of fabric, or fabrics, is to produce something, something skillfully produced, actually. Something that's produced with skill and is the foundation for, the essential foundation for, in this case, our society, this meditative society. And so we should understand that this community, this society, it has a name, but it has a life. It's not a static thing. It's an ever-growing, dynamic, evolving, unfolding, changing thing, just as we are individually. And so even though there's a name and it seems to be a fixed thing, oh, Seattle Insight Meditation Society, it's not. It never has been. It's been a growing, evolving, changing thing. And while the change is recurrent and familiar, it's quite easy to see it and feel the stability and the assurance and the continuity is quite noticeable and palpable. And when the evolving nature of it changes to less familiar, unpredictable, unexpected, the continuity of it feels threatened. But this is just an appearance. We're all here. We're all still here. We're all still contributing. We're all still doing our Dharma practice in whatever way we can, as best we can, weaving this society, weaving this community, weaving this fabrication into being. It's not going anywhere. There may have been some rents in the fabric of the community. This happens periodically, as it does with any clothing that's well worn. It gets thin in places, rips open, and can be repaired. Well, so too with communities. Things like that happen. You know, fractures, relationships fracture, expectations don't get met. The way things used to be don't happen that way anymore. But something new evolves. And it takes patience. And it takes doing our practice. It takes seeing the way things actually are moment to moment to trust that there will emerge from the wisdom of this community everything we need. Different, but still adequate. So when you talk about community, what is it that identifies us as a community? It's not just because we live in Seattle, but it's because we have a common, I think I would call it, aspiration. We all resonate with the teachings of the Dharma, which point to understanding suffering, the causes of suffering, and the end of suffering. And we all have some degree of aspiration for that. We practice for, of course, our own personal reasons, and there's many of them. There's many ways to articulate our suffering and our search for the end of suffering. But somehow, underneath all that we do, all the practices we do, there's this aspiration for some greater peace. But a community is not just a group of like-minded people. It's a group of people who take responsibility for the group. They're empowered because they've made a commitment of some sort to belong and to share and to feel gratitude for what this community offers. And so it's important that we all recognize that we're all here because of our common aspiration, our love of the Dharma, our need for this community, our sense of responsibility for it, our sense of participating in it, and this joint ownership, really, and this feeling of communal sharing is valuable. Just think, you know, when you look at your mind, or when you first started your practice and you looked at your mind and you saw that chaotic mess in there, and somebody said, okay, figure it out, calm down, come to a peaceful relationship with everything that arises. Good luck. You know, I mean, none of us would have known what the heck to do, let alone had the courage to keep doing it. And so we are entirely reliant upon one another. You know, the Sangha is one of the refuges. It may not always be a refuge, it can be a stormy refuge, but nevertheless, it's a refuge because if we had to do this work alone of disentangling the heart and the mind from suffering and the causes of suffering, we'd either go crazy or quit. We wouldn't know what to do. And so, while none of us here are the Buddha, and probably we all have work to do, room for improvement, still we can be inspired just by the quality of our practice, or the quality of others' practice, the people that just show up week after week, keep these doors open, keep the microphones working. There's a commitment there. And it's not just a commitment to keep the microphones working. It's a commitment to this group, this society, the sharing of the Dharma. So, what I want to talk about tonight is the Dharma. And it's said that, you know, to establish your life in the Dharma, or to establish a group in the Dharma, to establish the Dharma in our community, it requires three trainings, or three pillars, really. And the three pillars of the Dharma are generosity, dana, sila, or living in harmony, and bhavana, which is the development of the mind. Dana, sila, bhavana. Generosity, living in harmony, and development of the mind. Now the development of the mind is both the samadhi, or the tranquility of the mind, learning how to calm the mind down with mindfulness, but also insight or understanding, how to grow in insight and understanding through the practice of Vipassana. Both of them are required or involved in the development of the mind. And when you think of all that you've done in the course of your Dhamma practice, isn't this what we've learned? To practice generosity, to learn to live in harmony by not hurting one another, by how we speak, how we act, developing our mind through mindfulness and understanding, calming down and taking a look. And is there anybody that doesn't have any room for improvement in any of those areas? I'd gladly give up the chair. Not that I have plenty of room for improvement myself, but you can see that it takes practice. All of these are practices. It's not like somebody's got it and somebody doesn't. We all have our strengths. We all have our limitations. It's important to recognize them within ourselves. It's not so important to recognize them in others, but to know that there's room for improvement. When the Buddha was asked, well, what is it that you teach? He said, all Buddhas, there were Buddhas prior to this Buddha, and there will be Buddhas after this Buddha. All Buddhas teach to do good, avoid causing harm, and develop the mind. So what does doing good mean in the context of, well, our being here? The Buddha said in the Anguttara Nikaya, he said, bhikkhus, or those who practice, he's speaking to those who practice, calling them bhikkhus. We're bhikkhus to the extent that we practice, or as we take on the practice. He said, there are these two kinds of persons that are rare in the world. Two kinds of persons, rare in this world. One who takes the initiative in helping others, and one who is grateful. Those who initiate, take the initiative to help others. This was what the Buddha was called to do after his awakening and after his enjoyment of the bliss of awakening for 7 weeks at the Bodhi tree. He kind of looked around and said, boy, wouldn't it be nice just to wander off into the Himalayas and kind of live out my life in bliss? And he considered it, but there were those who appealed to him and said, you know, there are some of us, or there are beings that have but a little dust in their eye, and would you please share the teachings with us so that we too can realize what you have realized, the end of suffering. And it was because of the Buddha's compassion that he decided to teach. It wasn't for any self-aggrandizement. He wasn't going to get anything, any kudos for teaching. In fact, he had a lot of struggles in his teaching. He got plenty of praise, he got plenty of blame. He got plenty of gains, he got plenty of loss. He had plenty of pleasure and he had plenty of sorrow. The Buddha is not immune to that. No other teacher is either. But why do people teach? Because it's something in it for them? Well, yes, there is. You know, there's something in it for us. We teach because we see others suffering in a way that we understand. That's why. And to the extent that we try or encourage practice, and if others can learn to recognize their suffering and disentangle their own heart and mind from suffering, that's the reward. That's the benefit. More wisdom in the world. I don't think anybody takes on teaching because it's a kind of a, as Ruth Dennison said, we're not just sitting up here licking the honey pot. No. It's a lot of work. A lot of responsibility, really, to be entrusted with others' hearts and minds, and to do the best you can to understand them, to understand where their suffering is, what they're holding on to, point to it, try not to get blamed for pointing to it, and see if they can recognize that and let go. And if so, then you can be happy for that. But to do good and to take that initiative to help others is bodhicitta. It's the heart, it's the mind that cares about others, compassion. This community wouldn't live another day without the compassion of caring for one another, caring for this community. Maybe it's just opening the door, maybe it's just sitting at the registration table, but why? Why do that? Well, because we care about this group somehow. So all of the members, everyone in this community that has offered any service to SIMS in any way, and it takes a lot, believe me, I know. It's because they care, have taken the initiative to care for others. And then those who are grateful, rare. But you know, even Western science, Western psychology has determined that expressing your gratitude is the most effective intervention for engendering a sense of well-being in your heart. The most effective way, the most effective thing you can do to engender a sense of well-being is to express your gratitude. It doesn't cost you anything. We all should be having a fantastic sense of well-being. We have so much to be grateful for. The teachings, how long has SIMS been going now? 20-some years, at least. This building, nearby retreat centers, visiting teachers up the wazoo, or whatever it is. Sorry, erase that. But what a gift. It's because SIMS is here, the teachers come. Thank you for this offer. Okay, so to do good means to, you know, initiate caring, compassion, compassionately for others, and to express your gratitude. It also means to practice generosity. SIMS lives on generosity. All teachers live on generosity. It's a practice. It's a practice on the part of teachers to offer the Dharma out of their generosity without expectation. I know there's a whole culture built up around supporting teachers through generosity, and it's a good culture, it's a good practice. It helps us be honest with the Dharma and not package it in a saleable form, but give you the truth. I mean, if we had to package the Dharma to sell only the good parts, you wouldn't get what you need to liberate the mind. But because we don't package it to sell, we're offering all we can, all we know, all we've learned to help you. And some of it is pretty unpalatable when you first hear it. It's not easy. And yet, it's our responsibility to share that with you too. So practicing generosity is, of course, a generosity of spirit, really. We're talking about our ability to share ourselves with others through service, share ourselves with others through knowledge, share this community with other teachers. Other teachers to share their generosity of spirit with you. Letting go in practicing generosity is just the easy part of letting go. One of my friends and colleagues has said that learning to practice vipassana, learning to practice insight, is learning how to let go. It's one long grieving process, because everything that we've ever experienced has passed. Everything that we're going to experience is just going to be fleeting. And until we learn to acknowledge that loss and grieve it effectively, we'll be hanging on. And the second noble truth is hanging on, grasping, clinging, is the cause of suffering. And so to the extent that we're still hanging on to anything, there's some potential for suffering. It may not be manifest yet, but when conditions change and you see you're holding on, then there's suffering. And maybe the most challenging, most subtle, and the most pervasive holding on that this Dharma path is going to ask us to let go of is our views and opinions. It is so easy to have views and opinions about things we know nothing about. I mean, in this role of being a teacher, a Dharma teacher, people sometimes come to me and ask what kind of car they should buy. Like, what do I know about cars? I mean, I have a car, but I don't know anything about cars. You know, what kind of car somebody should buy. I know the Dharma. But we need to be careful that we don't have views and opinions about things we don't know anything about. I mean, we do. We have all kinds of them. And beginning to recognize them is really vital, important. Because they grow under cover of darkness, under the cover of delusion, under the cover of belief, under the cover of identification, under the cover of expectation, allegiance, alliances, and we get all kinds of entanglements. But in the end, we have to see these views and opinions are mistaken beliefs. And we know that we're letting go, or we know that we're being asked to let go of some mistaken views and opinions when we feel disillusioned. Normally when we feel disillusioned, we think, I'm really disillusioned in you. You're not meeting my expectations. You know, you're not doing what I thought you should do. You know, I'm really disappointed. I'm really disillusioned in you. Or in Sims, or something, anything. And that form of disillusionment is really a call to wisdom. Because to the extent that we feel disillusioned, we're aware that something we're holding on to isn't happening. Some idea that we're holding on to is being challenged. It's not being fulfilled. Our expectations aren't being met. And so we're holding on. And normally when we think of disillusionment, it's some form of aversion. You know, you're disappointing me, I'm disillusioned in you, and there's this kind of aversion. I don't like it. I want it to stop. I want to get away from it. But actually, if we understand that disillusionment, we're no longer under the illusion of what we were believing, or what we were expecting, or what we were demanding. When we understand disillusionment in this way, we understand that, oh, there's wisdom knocking at the door. What are we now learning we need to let go of? We're holding on to something, and it's causing disillusionment. Well, we need to let go of something. And that's the task of awareness. Mindful awareness will tell you, will show you, what it is you're holding on to. We don't see it until we're disillusioned. We often don't see it. We're not aware that we're holding on. We're not aware that we're identified with things the way they've been, or things the way we want them to be. And so when they don't happen that way, we start feeling a lot of pain and discomfort and irritation and anger and aversion and despair and hurt and disillusionment with people and processes and all kinds of things. This is an invitation to let go and really understand that we've been holding on. Most of what I've been saying isn't on my notes, sorry. I'm going to have to catch up here somewhere. Okay, so anyway, gratitude, right, we're talking about gratitude. Yeah, here we go. That's appreciative joy. You know, we've received so much from our Dharma practice, it's almost impossible to imagine what life would be like if we hadn't been practicing as long as we have. I mean, we can't imagine. We can only know that we'd be crazier, you know, and a lot less kind of at ease with ourselves. So the Buddhist path of practice, of course, encoded in the Four Noble Truths, is the Noble Eightfold Path. And this path, as most of you know, is really three trainings. It's a training in sila, learning how to live in harmony with one another. It's a training in samadhi, learning how to calm the mind down. And it's a training in punya, wisdom, learning to see clearly into the nature of things. Now, in the practice of sila, sila is possible. Now, sila is the, like the precepts, living with the precepts or living in harmony with one another, being mindful of our intention before speaking and acting, or while speaking and acting in the world. That's sila. If we're paying attention, if we're monitoring through with mindfulness, our intention, the motivation for speaking and for acting in the world, then we're practicing sila. Now the rules are, to refrain from, to undertake the training to refrain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and the use of intoxicants. Okay, what's that mean? Well, what is that real? I mean, as commandments, they don't work very well. Let's face it, commandments don't work. But as a practice, we're asked to keep an eye on, keep this mindful eye on, the mind that remembers to recognize what is our intention before speaking and acting. And the foundation for sila, the two guardians of the world. And the two guardians of the world are hiri and otapa. These are two qualities of mind that are roughly translated as modesty and conscience. It's knowing within yourself when you start to say something or do something, you feel a little bit, whatever this state of mind is, a little bit sketchy, right? And we all know what that feeling is. It's like when we're trying to get away with something, that's pretty obvious. But there are other times when we say something, we blurt something out, and then we go, ooh, I just put my foot in my mouth. You know, as I just heard Heather mention to the young adults retreat that she held at Cloud Mountain recently, she said, a closed mouth gathers no foot. I thought that was really great. Closed mouth gathers no foot. Yeah, but anyway, the two guardians of the world, and when we say the world, the guardians of our community, the harmony of our community, is conscience and modesty. Having that sense that what I'm saying, about to say, or saying, is not contrary to my own understanding of what is skillful. Knowing that this isn't going to harm anyone. And when we do act, either with the knowledge that it could be harmful, or later recognize, ooh, that was harmful, we have to look. What did we not recognize in our own mind? What were we not mindfully aware of? This is a self-correcting thing. It's not like, hey, you said something, it hurt me, blame. It's not that. It's like our own self-monitoring, our own awareness needs to monitor these guardians within our own mind. It's not only what we feel would be harmful or cause distress or be an annoyance to someone, but it's also what the community standards are. What is the understanding? What is it that we all agree on as a community that is a kind of a minimum, a default position that we all buy into, we all subscribe to, because we're in this community. We expect to be treated with respect. We expect, we've made a commitment to speak the truth. We've made a commitment to and have this mutual understanding with one another that this is valuable, this is worth maintaining. I want to be in this group because we can each make that commitment to ourselves and one another. So these are the guardians of the world that protect our sila, our practice of the precepts. And then, of course, in sila, maybe the most difficult practice any of us will ever undertake is right speech. Skillful speech. Speech that is not harmful. So I want to speak just a little bit about the five conditions for skillful speech, because in any community, what is community? Community is communing. And yeah, we commune in a lot of different ways, but it involves a tremendous amount of talking with each other. And I don't know about you, but you know, my mouth goes faster than my mindfulness, unfortunately. You know, and I think probably for all of us, there's times where we just say things we'd rather erase. But, you know, they're embedded in our own mind. It may have come out, it may have hurt, we may apologize, but it's still in our mind, still in our heart that, oh, I said that, I did that. So when the Buddha talked about speech, skillful speech, he said there are these five conditions. The first is that when we speak, we should really check to see that whatever it is we got to say, that we can say it with the heart that has loving kindness and compassion in it. If we're speaking out of anger, if we're speaking out of rage, if we're speaking out of confusion, how can we have loving kindness and compassion? So the Buddha said, just check. Is there loving kindness and compassion? Now, it doesn't mean that you can't say very difficult things. Sometimes you have to say very difficult things, hard to hear things to people. We've all had that experience. But still, can we have loving kindness and compassion to do that? Because if there is loving kindness and compassion, then the connection that we have, the relationship we have, even if it's difficult what to say, will be maintained. And it honors and maintains, nourishes our connection with others. It ensures that we have no regret, no remorse, or no feeling of guilt because we've checked it out. We can say it with loving kindness. Now, the opposite of speaking with loving kindness and compassion is called Pisuna Wada. And Pisuna is fiend or demon. And Pisuna Wada is demon-like speech, fiend-like speech that fiends and demons engage in. Of course, none of us know any fiends or demons, but it's displayed in the form of backbiting, slander, speaking maliciously of others, in a way to defame, to damage their reputation, to malign them. We don't intend to do that. I mean, mostly we do not intend to. I mean, we're practicing. Mostly we don't intend to do that. But there are times we say things that about someone that we would never dare say to them. This is the practice for checking whether there's loving kindness and compassion in your heart when you speak. Can you say to the person what you're saying about them? And if you can't, why not? That's a steep bar. That's a high bar. But it's something to consider. Yes, we have to talk about people. We do. We can't live without talking about everyone or anyone who's not present. I've tried that practice. You know, even as a group, when I was on staff at the Meditation Center in Massachusetts, we tried to have a practice among us, never speaking about somebody who wasn't present in the conversation. We couldn't remember from one day to the next. We couldn't remember from 1 minute to the next not to do that. But that was our practice. We tried, but, you know, it's so common. Just think about it. We do that all the time, or a lot of the time. And to monitor the quality of your speech, check it out. Could you say to them what you say about them? The second condition for skillful speech is that it's gentle, that it creates a sense of intimacy and openness or transparency? Can we speak in a way that engenders love and puts people at ease, rather than furusawada, which is speaking crudely, harshly, unkindly, with rough, severe, fierce, in order to belittle or to shame or to taunt or to curse someone? So often it just comes out. It just comes out. We say things that are shaming, say things that are belittling, say things that are judging for whatever reason. You know, we don't like the fact that we do, but we do. And mindfulness, without practicing mindfulness, we won't recognize that. If we're practicing mindfulness, we'll recognize, oh, I just did something. I just said something. I need to fix that, because that inadvertent shaming or that inadvertent belittling of someone, you know, I'm speaking to you, Peter, and I'm talking about somebody over there and they don't hear us, and I go, da 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 da. You know, your relationship with them is now damaged because of what you heard me say. We don't intend that to happen, but I've changed your view of them. I've said something about them that causes you to kind of rethink the quality of your relationship with them, or who they are, or how they are. This is backbiting. This is shaming. And we have to recognize that. The way we recognize it is monitoring our own intentions, monitoring the effect that others' speaking has on us. So when you listen to others speaking to you about a third person, just notice what's going on in your mind about the third person. It's being changed, it's being manipulated, it's being, you know, kind of jerked around. In a group, in a community, this is dangerous. It's so damaging. You know, we don't intend to damage the community, but the fabric of our community is as fragile as the intention of any person who speaks. Every intention to speak is a thread in the fabric of this community. And if we're not aware of it, we'll tear that, we'll break that thread. We'll tear the fabric of our communal life there. We'll make a hole in it. And it has to be repaired, of course. I was living in the monastery in Rangoon, and when I was there, my teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, had invited a group. There was, you know, anywhere from 15 to 25 of them, of monks. They were about my age, actually. They were just a little younger than I was. And he had invited them there to Rangoon. Now, these were the cream of the crop in all of Burma. Number one or number two in the national exams. Those who finished their Dharma practice in a month or two. I mean, they're just fantastic scholars, fantastic meditators. And he'd invited them all there for them to learn English and for them to learn how to teach, so that they could become, well, we'd say in contemporary language, they could become missionaries. But they're not missionaries like going out and recruiting Buddhists, but they are now in all of the major centers and cities in the United States. There's a Burmese vihara in all big cities, and that whole community of monks that I was practicing with are the leaders of all those communities, all those centers. And not only in the US, but in Singapore and London and all around the world today. But when I would go down to their little section of the monastery, now I knew them because they were my age and they wanted to practice speaking their English with me. So I got to talk to them a lot. And they knew each other really well. They're living really close quarters and they know each other really well, and some of them are really bright and some of them are really good chanters, and some just number one in the country, and some are number two, and they're just fantastic, fantastic monks. I could not get them to say one thing about each other. They wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't praise, they wouldn't blame, they wouldn't say anything about each other. because that's their community. The fabric of their community relies on, you know, there being that kind of respect for one another, that kind of carefulness about what you say to others about each other. And they were all good friends, you know. They had their differences. I could see eventually. I could understand. You know, they had their differences, but they wouldn't say it. They wouldn't complain about one another. The third quality of skillful speech is that it be truthful. Now, this is the Bodhisattva's commitment. It said that the Bodhisattva, you know, broke all the precepts in his many lifetimes of developing the qualities of all the paramis to become a Buddha, hundreds of lifetimes. Broke all the paramis many times, so we don't have to worry about it. If you've broken all the precepts, we're right on course. Anyway, the one that he didn't break is truthfulness. Once he made the vow to become a Buddha, the Bodhisattva never spoke falsely. Now, when I usually give a talk about right speech, you know, we know that the Dharma is the truth, the way things are. We're practicing the Dharma, we're practicing the truth, we're practicing acknowledging the way it is for us, the truth. And the truth is valuable, it's important, it's significant, it's the path of liberation. And so let me ask you, have you made a commitment to always speak the truth? That's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, we're not likely to jam our hand into the air when we hear that question. Have you made a commitment to always tell the truth? So then the other option is, are you a liar? Well, we don't really want to acknowledge that either. You know, we're kind of like, we have a commitment to the truth when it's convenient, or when it doesn't interfere with our relationships with each other or whatever. That may be being polite, but may not be sufficient for freeing the mind, liberating the heart. So we have to think about that. But then again, we can look in our own lives and we can see the power of a commitment to the truth in people like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Aung San Suu Kyi, those people who just have such a commitment to the truth that they are willing to risk their lives to speak the truth, especially to power. Very difficult. And even in a small group like this, to speak your truth is a risk. It's a risk. And yet, this community will only survive if the truth is spoken. Okay, I mean, it's not always easy to hear. And it's often very disagreeable. You know, people have different perceptions. You know, there's not only one truth. Every one of us has got a piece of the truth. But if we listen to it all, if we can learn how to listen to it all and accommodate everybody's perceptions, even though they sound totally disagreeable, opposite ends of the spectrum, we have to be careful. We have to be careful what we cut out, what we can't tolerate, what we can't listen to, what we can't hear. If it's a truth, if it's coming from someone's heart, practice and awareness is valuable for this community. You know that old story. I think it's a. It's not a bedtime story, but it's a childhood story anyway, about the little boy who was guarding the community sheep out on the hillside outside the village, and totally bored, you know, waiting for the sheep to kind of fill up and go to sleep or whatever they do, you know, wander around. So he's totally bored one afternoon, so just to get a rise out of people, he shouts, "Wolf, wolf," you know, like, oh, there's a wolf stalking the sheep and going to carry the sheep away. And the villagers, hearing that, they all come running out to you know, save their property, the sheep. And when they get out there, the little boy says, "Ha ha, fooled you, there's no wolf." There you go. You shouldn't speak like that, because it's not true. And he was just a little boy, so he was just you know how little boys can be. So, you know, time goes by and gets bored another afternoon, and he says, "I'll do it again." He starts, "Wolf, wolf." And the villagers come out to save their sheep and drive the wolf away, and the little boy says, fooled you. You know, just being playful, but speaking falsely. So a couple of weeks later, wolf comes and starts carrying the sheep away, and he goes, wolf, wolf, and the villagers all say, don't listen to him. You know, he's just lying. You can't rely on him. You can't depend on him. Don't listen to him. And they lost their common property. There's a lesson in that for us. Right? We have a common, we have something of value amongst us, this community. It's our common property. It's our communal property. It's this trust. It's this understanding we have with one another. It's this common aspiration. It's our common commitment to maintain the harmony of this community by not speaking falsely. As painful as it is, we have to tell the truth. Okay. Because if we speak falsely, we threaten our common good. Right? We can lose it because we're not speaking truthfully, but we're not able to hear the truth. Something to think about, how we do that. So the fourth condition for skillful speech, and this is a challenging one, is it should be beneficial. And we may have many things, we may have a lot to say, but if it's not beneficial, why bother? Really, think about it. Now, of course, if we think of what is not beneficial speech, I like this word in Pali. I always get a laugh out of this one. You know, non-beneficial speech in Pali is sampapalapa wada. I mean, it sounds like blah, 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 right? You know, that's what it is. It's just nonsensical, it's superficial, it's useless, it's frivolous, it's gossip, it's rumor, it's chatter, it's insignificant, it's what you see on TV. So what's left? You know, I mean, the Buddha had this list of topics that monks and nuns should not talk about. I didn't bring it with me, but I kind of got it in my mind. And of course, you know, we got to understand that monks and nuns are 24/7. They're working on their minds, trying to liberate their minds. We're working as best we can. Maybe not 24/7, but we're working on it. But so the topics that were unedifying for monks and nuns while they're practicing are, you know, any talk about politicians, wars, gossip, the opposite gender, clothes, food, jewelry, adornments, houses, cars, chariots, you know, the past, your family, all these things that most of us are totally consumed with talking about. You know, we stuff it in our face by reading the news every day, all kinds of stuff that's useless. And then we repeat it. Hey, did you see that article? Did you read that news? Did you watch that program? Why do we do that? Is it really beneficial? I hate to bring it up. So then the Buddha said, well, these are the topics that you should speak about, or that you could speak about, that are edifying, that are useful, that are beneficial to those who are practicing the Dharma. You know, talk about mindfulness, talk about contentment, talk about, you know, the strenuousness of your practice, talk about the, you know, the seclusion of mind from the development of samadhi, and things like that. So next time you go out to dinner with some friends, you know, you could just, you know, bring up the topic, you know, let's talk about the strenuousness of your practice this past week. Okay, that's why we don't, because, well, when we speak about useless things and gossip and chatter, a useless, frivolous thing, we again threaten the fabric of our community, the fabric of our shared life. And, you know, when we speak in a way that is harmful for whatever reason or in whatever way, in the monastic code, when you act in such a way as to break any of the rules, then you have to do a confession. And you know, the confession is really not, it's not a shaming thing. It's not like I'm a bad boy, you know, type of thing. It's more like, oh, I recognize that I've done something to put me outside of the community. I've said something, I've done something to kind of temporarily put me outside the community, and I want to acknowledge that so that I can feel welcome to come back. And so when we go to confession, we just say to an elder, you know, I want to confess something. You know, I mistakenly or carelessly or out of lack of mindfulness or out of ill intent, I did this, or I said that, or I, you know, did something. And the elder, instead of saying, bad boy, you shouldn't do that, he just says, it's good that you recognize that this is an unskillful thing to do. It's good that you recognize that. Now please try harder. Please try in the future not to do that again. Because you recognize it yourself. It's not like I have to shame you. It's skillful for you to recognize that you've done something harmful in the community. Skillful. The last or the fifth condition that the Buddha spoke about as a condition for skillful speech is that if we can say it with a loving heart, and if we can say it gently in a way that's going to be heard by the other, and if it's true and beneficial, we have to say it at the right time. Patience is a virtue. You know, the first 20 years of the Buddha having monks having taught and monks being ordained, the first 20 years for the community of monks, there was only one rule. Patience. Be patient. Of course, they were all fully enlightened and didn't have any hang-ups, but still, they had to practice patience. So the Buddha said, you know, patience is the supreme virtue. But it's hard. It's hard because sometimes patience feels like we're frothing at the bit. This is not patience, right? Patience is really letting go temporarily of what it is we think we need to do. Just being patient, just allowing, you know, waiting with awareness for the wisdom to recognize when conditions support saying what you got to say. Just blurting it out, just being reactive, being, you know, inflamed and just kind of spouting off. It may be true. It may be intended to be beneficial. We may even have some kind of sarcastic compassion. But if it's not going to be heard because the other person is not there, is not in the place to hear it, it's up to us. It's up to our wisdom to determine, to recognize, oh, this is the time to say what needs to be said. But one thing that we have to consider also, there may never be a right time. It can be useful, it can be beneficial, it can be true, it can be spoken with loving kindness, right? But there may never be the time. I'm on page 4. There's 7 pages. I guess I'll have to come back. So I want to end. You know, the fabric of our community is very thickly, tightly woven, and I've only gotten a few warps and wefts in. But you get the point, right? Care, consideration. So I want to end my sharing and then take a few questions by reading a poem by William Stafford. Now, William Stafford is, you know William Stafford? Well-known poet. It is said that he could hear the stars fall. When you saw a falling star, he had that kind of sensitivity. He was really great, great, great guy. It's called a ritual to read to each other. I think it's appropriate for this community. I think it's appropriate for any community. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood, storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, each holding the other's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not recognize the fact. To know what occurs but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line of conversation may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes, no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. Thank you for listening to the Dharma. So there's a few moments, for 10 or 12 moments, for questions if you have any about anything. And if there's not, we can sit here and enjoy the silence. But I'm happy to try to answer any questions. So the comment is about the list of topics unworthy or unedifying for monks and nuns at the time of the Buddha to talk about politicians' wars and whatnot. And how do we translate that into our times and our conditions? I think, as you rightly acknowledged, we have some severe conditions to deal with in our communal life, the larger community. And we do need to discuss, we need to become informed, we need to discuss, we need to share our understanding, our concern with others. And of course there are politicians involved. Can we talk politics without politicians? Can we talk about political issues? Can we talk about what matters to us without demeaning others? Without maligning others? I think there's a distinction to be made there that really is worth our consideration as people who want to speak the truth and want to speak truth to power and want to speak, you know, and want to create as or do no harm by being just angry. And I think it's a challenge. It's a real challenge for us who want to be aware and also want to participate in the larger community politically. It takes a lot of awareness. And of course, we're not monks and nuns, and we're living in the world, and we're, and the conditions of the world are very different. But you know, the Buddha talked to kings and queens and ministers of all kinds. You know, tried to prevent wars, and you know, tried to get them to behave with each other and not to invade each other. And he had all kinds of conversations with both sides. So the challenge for us is, can we speak to both sides? Can we share the Dharma perspective of both sides? I had a young man that was, well, not young, he was older than I was, but anyway, he was a man who was doing some community Dharma work, and he went through the training, the community Dharma leaders training, and then he got to live in New Mexico, and his particular interest was in getting the capital punishment outlawed in New Mexico. And he became a speaker all over the state, speaking about and speaking against capital punishment. And, you know, I was mentoring him, and, you know, one of the last times he came to talk to me, he was talking about his work in trying to get the capital punishment stopped. And I said, you know, Don, can you speak to the proponents of capital punishment about the Dharma? Or can you only speak to the opponents of capital punishment about the Dharma? That's your practice. Learning how to speak to the proponents about the Dharma. And it's challenging. You know, but that was the requirement. And as you know, capital punishment has been outlawed in New Mexico. Isn't it?
Nebraska.
I think New Mexico too. But anyway, that was his work. But anyway, I think politics is a slippery slope, but certainly worth all the awareness we can bring to it, all the truthfulness we can bring to it. Pardon?
Haven't some monks taken very powerful positions?
Yeah, monks do take powerful positions. Look at Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, during the Vietnam War and continuing. And you know, other monks. There was a couple of monks from Burma were just recognized recently at the Nobel Committee somehow recognized them as being taking extraordinary steps to protect some of the Rohingyas at different times in the last few months. Is, you know, at under threat of their own life, was willing to put their own life on the line. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about truth.
Truth. You know, the strength with which you hold an opinion, it does not make it true. It does not. You know, so what is true? You know, that you can only know what is true by practice awareness. It's not, truth is not a matter of belief. Truth is a matter of observation and recognition. And so if we practice, we'll see what's true in here. And we'll see, we'll have more accurate perceptions of everything else in the world. It's not a belief. I can't even say it's what a person understands, because a lot of people understand because of beliefs. But if your understanding comes from direct observation of the way things are, and you articulate your understand the truth of what you have experienced, then that would be true. Yeah? But how to translate that into generic truth that others can agree or disagree with, that's a challenge. That's a challenge. But that's the requirement. You know, I had somewhere in my notes that, you know, practice is not a matter of beliefs, as we know. I mean, you can read a Dharma book and say, yeah, I believe that. It's great. That doesn't free your heart and mind a bit. You know, you actually got to do the work. And doing the work is paying attention and observing and learning from your own experience the truth that you've read in a book and agree with. Because just agreeing as a matter of belief does not free the heart and mind. Cannot.
So a person
Someone can read a truth and agree with it because somebody else has written it. They could agree with it. That's right. That's right. Someone can acknowledge their own experience and how it is, and this is the truth for them, and somebody else can acknowledge their experience that might be similar and have a different understanding. That's right. Yeah. And even in our own practice, you know, as we practice, you know, we start out with, you know, a fair amount of delusion. And as we practice, we get simple truths. We get simple recognitions. We're like, oh, this is the way it is. Okay, that's good enough for now. But if you keep practicing, later you'll find out, well, that's not quite right. Or that wasn't quite right. Let me just keep practicing. And so we can't rely on the past, our past experience, for the truth. We have to rely on the present moment's experience. Yeah, because our understanding of what's true is going to change. Yeah. It's an ongoing thing. It's an ongoing evolvement, I think. And conditions change. Conditions change. So how can the truth be that stable? There are truths like, you know, the Four Noble Truths. There are scientific truths. There are things like that that, you know, have been observed continuously. Of course, that's true. But in our personal experience, things change. Yeah, Peter.
I'm having trouble with how to articulate this, but I guess I've been sort of dealing with a situation this week where it seems to involve, you know, trying to observe the facts of a situation and hearing different people's points of view and just. A lot of the things that you've talked about are very relevant to it, but it seems like a lot of them are kind of conflicting. And so, like non-harm and truth, for instance, those in this situation, you know, it seems like that if I took action based on what the truth is, it would harm somebody in terms of... that's the way it looks. So, and you spoke earlier about sometimes the truth is very difficult, and you know when it's within a community or you know affecting I don't know someone's behavior or their performance and how that affects the community. Mm. Can you talk about that anymore? Probably sorry about that.
No, it's very difficult. You know, if you have more than one person considering a question, or even if you have just one person considering a question, you can have a lot of conflict. You know, I mean, because I can have two opinions about one thing. So, I think the responsible thing to do is to try to hear everything. You know, I mean, especially if you're responsible for a group decision, or you know, you got a lot of people participating, and then you have to. Something's going to happen. It's like, how far back do you have to step to be able to hold the whole thing? You know, because if you're just kind of like in there, just kind of in this little piece, you're gonna agree with this person and disagree with that person, or agree with this cohort and disagree with that cohort. So somehow you have to recognize that that's going on, but you can only recognize that that's going on if you step back outside of both of them. And say, okay, now, this is what's going on here. Get a bigger picture. Then, you know, sometimes you can find a solution from a different perspective that you couldn't find up close. This happens in practice all the time. You know, if you're practicing and you're keeping a close eye on things and you're looking, you get to this place where you go, God, I don't know, should this way, that way? It's like, is it this way, is it that way? And you think, I got to have the answer. I got to go to the teacher. I got to get the answer. And Upandita would always say, I can answer your question, but for every question I answer, you're going to have two more. If you keep practicing, you'll answer your own question. And what would happen, inevitably, almost universally, I would keep practicing with this tension of, I can't accommodate it. I don't know what to do. It's just you keep practicing until something happens. You know, the mind just opens to another way, another dimension, another way of thinking, and you realize, I didn't need the answer to that question. That was the wrong question. You know, it's like I was just caught in a particular perspective that just had it either or, and now you've kind of opened to a perspective that, well, that doesn't even matter anymore. There's no either or going on in this new perspective. And it's hard to know, it's hard to trust that that's what's going to happen. But after you've seen it happen that way dozens of times, eventually you know, oh, this is the way it's going to happen. It's going to feel like conflict for a long time, or for a period of time. It just, all I can see is this conflict. And we're in, you know, we agree with this one, we don't agree with that, then we agree with that one, we don't agree with that. It's just like, oh my God, you know. No, I know. Hey, believe me. You know, we all have been in those kind of things. We probably still are. But there's another place. There's another way of looking at it where you're not outside of it. You're not denying it. You're not avoiding it. You're moving to a place that can hold all of it. I've seen it happen in myself and in other groups. So I have some trust. It takes a lot of trust to know that. And it's not like you can kind of follow a technique to get to it. It's not like technique.
Yeah.
It's not susceptible to a technique, but it's susceptible to awareness. Awareness and understanding. Especially if you have good intentions among people. If you have a lot of hostility among people, then it's going to be more problematic. But if you have good intentions among people, then you can do that. You know, our time together is up. It's been wonderful. I hope it was for you. It was for me. I always have fun at these things. So, thank you very much. I know I was supposed to say something about Dana. I did. I talked about generosity. Okay, that's it. There's an opportunity up there if you wish. But also know that, you know, communities like this, this organization, this community thrives on, flourishes on, only survives on our willingness to be generous. Not just money in the envelope for the teachers, but generous with our time, generous with our knowledge, generous with our love for one another, love of the organization, love of the community, and sharing, trying to contribute in whatever way we can, sharing our lives. You know, if you're practicing Dharma, you got a lot to share. You got a lot to share. So take the opportunity to share with this community. Thank you.